From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by you. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
We thought we would be arrested in jail.
Yes.
We didn't have any idea that we would be beaten. No, we were prepared to go to jail. We were prepared to be arrested. But we didn't know. We didn't have any concern that we would be beaten by the state troopers.
Last weekend, religious, political, and civil rights leaders traveled to Alabama to mark the 54th anniversary of the tragedy that came to be known as Bloody Sunday, with Alabama state troopers attacking peaceful marchers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. The pilgrimage was organized by the Faith and Politics Institute, and Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline was among those in attendance, and we're going to get his impressions later in this week's show. But first,
humanity is a many-splendored thing. We need to recognize that and participate in it. Racism and misogyny exclude whole segments of creation from the fullness of creation. A little human humility is in order if any of us are to survive this moment in history.
The name Sister Joan Chittister is familiar to most Americans. For over a half century, Sister Joan has been a passionate voice for women's rights. From a woman religious in a denomination that has not always seemed eager to prioritize the issue. In fact, if you think about it, the Second Vatican Council, which certainly went a long ways towards defining what most of us know as the Catholic Church, ended only 53 years ago. That's a lot of advocacy and activism for one nun. But that's who she is. Sister Joan is a theologian, an educator, and a prolific author. Her brand new book is titled The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage, and I am delighted that it brings my dear friend Sister Joan Chittister to State of Belief Radio. Sister Joan, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you, my dear brother Welton. A conversation with you is worth anything.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, you're very kind. I eagerly opened your new book, well aware that when you write, I find wisdom as well as inspiration, eager to benefit from your insights and counsel. I met your first words, "We have a choice." What is our choice?
Oh, dear. I gave that a lot of thought, Welton, before I opened like that. But it's the only proper opening, especially at this moment in time, and maybe especially in the United States for the sake of the rest of the world. Our choice is whether or not we will continue to be the Word of God we've set out in each of our traditions to do, or we will simply succumb to the secular values that are corrupting not just this country, but the welfare of the globe. Our choice is to decide, like the biblical prophets did, whether or not at this call of God to continue the creation that God gave us to complete, Will we commit ourselves to that, or will we put it down for the sake of public values that seek personal profit rather than the co-creation of the globe? Will we simply roll over and say, well, that's the way it is now, so we have to do it, and ignore the values of a loving God who built them right into this creation? Or will we, as a third choice, recognize our moral responsibility as co-creators of this globe and of life, and take our place in creating what God began? God left this globe unfinished because that's our role. What other reason do we have to be alive when we divide ourselves in half, when we divide our colors in half, when we divide our classes in half, and when we divide the peoples of the earth in half, calling some of them worthless, calling some of them less than human, calling half the human race women unacceptable? We have lost our way, and we have a choice. Right now, at this moment in history, it's a crossover moment in time. We don't have much time left. I'm 82 now, Weldon. I've been at this for over 50 years, and every year it has gotten more and more dangerous. The word has gotten more and more muted. The voices have gone more and more silent. And it brought me back to the prophets. I simply went back and immersed myself in the biblical prophets, saying, life's been bad before, John. Don't worry about it. What, you know, see how that worked out. See what happened then. And what I saw was some very reluctant seekers who finally recognized that they had a choice, that they were being called to choose to be the word as well as the witness as well as the word. And thanks to that is who knows better than you do in everything you've done with the soul of this country, that it's only on that path that we ever prosper. And it's a long answer to a beautiful question, Welton, but the point is that I really do believe the time is now. The decisions that we make as people, as politicians, as Christians, as human beings, will determine the future of the globe.
What are your thoughts on where things stand for women right now?
That's really one of our most important questions, I think, Wilton, and so I thank you for asking it. Why? Because we're at a point now of seduction, meaning good things have happened. I wouldn't deny that, and I certainly wouldn't denigrate them. I'm happy for the fact that we even recognize the woman's question as a human question, as something that women and men must solve together if our agendas are going to be treated wholly, not just partially, not just half of us deciding what the rest of the world needs. And we have made that now, it seems to me, not just in the United States, but trust me, around the world. Every country I go to, every nation I work in, has women's commissions, has women's goals. A lot of that came out of the Beijing Conference for Women, where nations committed themselves to the women's issue as a national issue. So there's been intellectual progress. There's even been some moral progress. Thanks to the churches, so many of you have done such marvelous analysis of this and come up with such good theology, that the churches have the right now, many of them, to see themselves as leaders in what I would call the major moral question of this century. Having said that, the statistics don't confirm it. We still have too little presence of women in the decision-making arena in the world. As Americans in the year 2019, we are celebrating like high school kids the fact that we finally have 100 and some women in Congress. Now, is that a healthy sign? Yes, it is. But it's a very new healthy sign. And I would argue that there is still reason to consider the fact that in 2016, there was as much misogyny working at that election as there was politics. So we have goals that must be met. We're a long way from them, and yet we're further toward them than we've ever been as a human race. And I simply maintain and continue to teach everywhere I go not to be depressed, not to be in despair or dismay, but to understand that if we have any task right now, it is to maintain the seriousness and the visibility of the woman's question. If they are able to suppress the question, to ignore the question, by telling themselves that seductive little answer, "Oh, Sister Joan, things are so much better now," when there is nothing on earth that will prove that for women as a class, then it will take another 50 to 75 years just to legitimate the question again.
There's lots more still to come with Sister Joan Chittister and later Rabbi Jack Moline on the Edmund Pettus Bridge 54 years after Bloody Sunday in Selma. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. My guest is Sister Joan Chittister, whose new book is titled The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage. Joan, you are a true feminist. Have you always worn that mantle? And if so, how did that work in the just post-Vatican Church?
Well, I started to smile when you started the question, Welton, because when I'm really in a confessional mode, I will admit immediately, I was a feminist before there was a word for it. I got it from my mother. She saw a very intensely academic little kid in front of her, and she nurtured that all the way. You can be anything you want to be. I have a childhood story about, it was the Christmas after my father died. I was about three. My mother's brothers and sisters took great pains to make sure that, quote, the baby would have a good Christmas. So it was a constant, what do you want from Santa Claus? What do you want to get? And I knew exactly. I was about three. I said, I want a doctor's kit. Now, I don't know if you remember well, but they used to come in little tin cookie boxes,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I knew exactly what a doctor's kit looked like. So on Christmas morning, here's this little pile of presents in the middle of the floor. And I went to them, and I was looking for the doctor's kit. And I pushed aside everything else, and sure enough, down there was this square box that I knew had to be it. I picked it up and rattled. It was metal. And I got really excited and I tore the paper off. And my good Lord, it wasn't a doctor's kit. It was a nurse's kit. So I looked around the circle where the uncles were, of course, and I said something like this: this is wrong. This is a mistake. And my Uncle Lucid, what do you mean? That's what you wanted for Christmas. I said, no, I didn't. I said, I wanted a doctor's kit. This is a nurse's kit. Take it back. And I went over and put it on his lap. My mother told that story for years. She said she wanted to faint and die in front of her whole family. Now, here's a three-year-old who knew the difference. Remember that. So for me, the role of girls, what games girls could play, what places girls could go, yes, it was a conscious agenda. It was never unconscious. And I admit to you, it was never acceptable. Now, put it where you put it, Wilton. Put it right in the middle of the Catholic Church in Vatican II. And here you have, ironically, think of it, who knows this better than you? You realize, of course, that the Catholic Church was built by Roman Catholic women, the sisterhood. All these orders of sisters who had taught all these small children, who had built all these academies at their own expense, who had educated all these nuns to be the intellectual shoulders of the church itself. And they had won. They were right. They got what they wanted. They had a core of the most educated women as a group who had ever existed in any society anywhere. Now, with that came an expectation of acceptance and change in their own lives. But more importantly, perhaps, with that came some of the best education, the best educated women as a group, as a class of women, than anybody had ever seen. And when they went into Vatican II with its admonition to Catholics and to nuns in a particular way to review their charism, the needs of the sisters and the needs of the people, and decide what that would call for, would mandate in this day and age, in the mid-60s, early 70s, and do it. And we began to, there was disturbance aplenty. We moved out of the system that we had spent a couple hundred years building, the educational system, not completely, but we allowed our sisters to find what they felt needed to be done and to do it. So while we were opening up the soup kitchens, the peace centers, the child care centers, study centers, the spirituality centers, while we were adding layer upon layer to the ministries of the Catholic Church, we were being called into chanceries to be scolded for either not wearing a uniform or for leaving the schools. Our thinking was we'd spent 150 years educating a Catholic laity. If the Catholic laity wanted a Catholic school system, we had prepared them to assume it while we would go back where we belonged, and that was with the needy or in conjunction with the benefactor, wealthy, and out of that would come the same strength that it had always been, but in a different form.
Why is the time now?
Well, there are multiple reasons, of course, but we might as well deal with the obvious ones first. We have fallen into a pattern in this country, and we see it now emerging around the globe, of two things. One is partisanship as a political form, and secondly, the whole notion of confusion given the rate of change at all levels and the vacuum that that produces. This you can see this whole trend of the strong figure, the strong man who will solve everybody's problems. So you have these groups emerging around the world: Maduro, Erdogan, Duterte, Trump. So here we are in a stage that is beginning to look like imperial presidencies. where parliaments and representative governments are being divided into a kind of political classism. And you are feeling, again, just like in the 60s, the simmering unrest of people from all the classes who see one world that we're living in, the end of the industrial age in one form, and the effects of another, the beginning of this highly electronic age, technological age, and in the middle of it, the spiritual mind trying to determine what is the role of the spiritual life and the spirituality institutions at this moment in history. The time for untying these knots, for developing human consensus rather than imperial presidencies, the time for educating ourselves to the effect of the system. Well, 3 years ago, they told us that within 20 years, we would begin to see the effects of climate change. Now, 6 months ago, whole groups of scientists began to say to us, it's too late, it has already started. And who of us can say that we really believe that things are still the same as they were when we were young people in the 60s? So when you put confusion, partisanship, and this search for the strongman answer and the suppression of national concerns, you're in trouble. Well, I mean, this thing is boiling over. Remember that our leadership 30 years ago began the definition of partisanship. This did not happen in Trump's era. This happened when they decided that Hastert's law said, I will take nothing, no law, no bill to Congress until I know that it already has enough Republican votes to pass. So we suddenly had a government being shaped and formed that instead of having the goal of passing bipartisan legislation, which means something for everybody, it means a win-win solution, we now had given the power of the government to that plus one vote. If you have a 50-49 split and you can get 51 votes, you have it. And you can run the country for 8 years. The effects of that on us will not go unnoticed over time.
I agree with you that we are really needing better leadership. I think we're also needing more informed citizens who demand better leadership. And this is kind of heretical, I think, but you've brought it up and I want to affirm it. I'm almost at a point where I want to replace partisanism with true patriotism and to see churches and other houses of worship affirm that. Am I off track there?
Oh, my God, no. Oh, excuse me. I meant it for a prayer. I mean, dear God, let it be known that this is the only way through this. That somehow or other, it's funny, I'm about to share the most unfinished thought I have because I've only begun to wrestle with it in the last 3 months as I see this building up. When some issue comes up, they tell you immediately if it's going to pass or not because you have so many Democrats or you have so many Republicans. You can count the vote before you bring the bills in. Doesn't make any difference what you want to do. We just need this plus one figure, right? And I've been saying to myself, well, I don't know. I think we should sit down and discuss again the Constitution in the light of the notion that we're supposed to be there for all the people. We're supposed to be signing laws that make everybody's life a little better, not worse. So I wonder if it isn't time for us to say something like this. A law won't pass unless we have at least 30% of both sides who vote for it, so that we know that the body of our legislators say, this is good for all our states. This is good for all my people. And then to see the churches begin to realize that there is a spiritual, there is a moral, in my opinion, Welton, for too long have the churches and their spiritual leadership and people like us forgotten that we've been playing religion, but not witness. We think religious practices, we go to church, we have the services, we have the communion service, we say the psalms, we sing the hymns, and we go and do it regularly. All of us, in whatever languages or forms or out of whatever traditions, we're all there in church. And we're all there for our personal sanctification. Because that's what, ironically, the separation of church and state bred. That somehow or other, we stayed in our warm cocoons, in our nice caves with nice people. We moved with our own, and we knew we were safe. If we don't somehow or other begin to preach the integration of society, the Jesus who walked from Galilee to Jerusalem with Roman soldiers and Canaanite women and dying children and forsaken, disabled people and those who were arguing the law. If we can't all do that together, well, we can't pull this out. We won't pull this out. There's too much history that tells us that a nation can only take so much division and so much ignorance, and then it's over.
I'll talk some more with Sister Joan Chittister in our next segment. And later, a pilgrimage to Selma, Alabama, to mark a bloody turning point in the civil rights movement. We'll hear from Rabbi Jack Moline. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. Take a look at it. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. My guest is Sister Joan Chittister. Her latest book is titled The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage. A few years ago, I did a book on people's favorite words, and Maya Angelou sent me her favorite word, which was courage. And she explained, without courage, no one can practice the other virtues consistently. The subtitle of your book is A Call to Uncommon Courage. Please talk about the kind of courage you see as being so badly needed right now.
The interesting thing is we have a lot of noise, and we have a lot of people selling soap. And I'm not saying that the soap isn't good soap, but the thing that strikes me about it all the time is that as spiritual people, we have forgotten that the motto for our courage lies in the biblical prophets. These were simple people. They had small businesses. They had sheep farms. They were farmers and olive growers. Obviously, they heard these questions, these very questions, in their hearts. And every one of them knew that something had to be done. That was the call. I know something has to be done. The only reason this book was written, Welton, was because I found myself getting up every morning more and more concerned about the environment in which I was living and the road that we were on in every dimension. And I began to say to myself, what am I doing? How do we change this? Where is this going? Am I the only one who's this disturbed? Am I the only one? Remember, you said to me, what are these choices we have? And I said, when you look at a situation, you can say, oh, I quit this. I'm not going there. And you can run and find your own cave and live in it. That's your first choice. Your second choice is to say, that's the way it is. You know, I mean, come on. You're old fashioned and you're out of style. Somebody here knows what they're doing. Just do it. Don't worry about what it looks like when it's being done. Or the third choice is to say, I see the moral deterioration of my world around me. I hear the call of the Creator for a responsibility to co-creation, and I've got to get into this discussion. I've got to be part of this. I have to do something to raise a voice. I didn't say raise an army. I didn't say raise a fight. I didn't say raise a division. I didn't say raise a revolution. I said raise the voice.
I think a huge obstacle to moral clarity today is the overload of conflicting information and turning morality over to politics. How do you go about distilling truth so that the kind of courage you write about becomes even possible?
Well, what I try to say in the book is I'm not talking about answers now. I'm talking about that process of distillation in a demassified communication cult where every voice that you're hearing is owned by somebody else, some other group, some other interest, some other desire, some other support system. And it seems to me that unless or until we take it seriously, even in our churches, to bring together study groups around a piece of legislation. I can remember the days when you turned on the old television and somebody was sitting there with a whiteboard and said, now, here's the new tax law, and here's what's going to happen. You're going to do this, this, and this. You'll gain this, this, and this. You'll lose this and this. You educated the country all at one time. Remember when parishes, congregations everywhere had wonderful study groups, Bible study groups, Bible study groups. I'd love to have a Bible study group on the tax law. I'd love to see what the Bible says about the Corban as opposed to what the legislators say, what is the good tax distribution for this country. I'd love to see parishes look at the American budget in small groups and say, now, tell me where this fits in your Bible study. I don't know any other way to distill truth, Welton, except to study, to listen to good people, make good explanations, so that somehow or other we can walk out knowing that we have each been truly a seeker, and that we will seek together till the end rather than split and give that plus one vote the control of the country.
Joan, it feels like we're just getting started, but our time is running out. I want to ask you if you could share just one lesson that you've learned in your life in ministry with the young novice you once were. What would that lesson be? What do you wish you had known then that you know now?
Believe it or not, that's one of the easiest questions you've asked today, Welton. I know exactly what I learned that changed my whole life. And it came around Vatican II when the changes, especially, you can imagine, when you were looking at Roman Catholic sisters, those big orders of sisters, who you all knew like cookie cutter people out of the 19th century. And when you saw that massive change, 360-degree change among a subculture of the culture, I can remember being in the middle of it. I had just gotten my doctorate in communication theory and with an emphasis on social psych out of Penn State. It had been as valuable contemplation for me as my scripture study had ever been. It made scripture live and walk for me. And so I was completely immersed in all this, but at the same time, I was watching the terrible struggle. What did you keep? What did you leave? What did you, who was right? Who was wrong? Everybody was dividing. Polarization was the champion of the day. And I discovered something. It changed my entire spiritual life. And that is, people are good-hearted. Each of us hears the voice of God in a different language within our souls, out of a different filter of experience, out of different hopes and needs. But when we make traditionalism rather than the wind of the Holy Spirit, that's change, the task of our moral choices, we bring nothing to fullness and run the risk of destroying literally thousands of years of growth, development, goodness, and vision. We have to begin to see, I had to begin to see that change was grace. And that I had the responsibility to deal with each of them with an open heart, with a good mind, and with the willingness to work through the rough edges of each of them, to trust people. I can remember a vote in our community. Well, believe it or not, we were split. And it looked as if there was no way out of it. It was in the late 70s, if I remember correctly. And suddenly, this Marist brother, a psychiatrist who was studying in the United States and had begun to move from community to community to help them facilitate some of these difficult decisions about change. Every time they took the vote, we locked and locked and locked. And finally, he said, I'd like to change the vote a little for this community just to see what happens to it. Everybody sighed a sigh of relief because nobody wanted to vote on the first resolution again. And he said, if I ask you to vote on this, are you willing to do it? I will trust my sisters to do what they need to do on whatever the issue was. The vote passed almost unanimously. It was such a wake-up moment for the community. The polarization ended that very day. Each of us had taken a pen and written, I will trust all my sisters to do what they think is right about. And the minute that happened, the minute human trust took over from human competition and power grabbing, we were ready to go. We rose out of our tomb that day, Welton. And was it easy? No. Was it really decided that day? Not the issue, wasn't. But the trust was. And every day we trusted more. And nobody did anything ridiculous in doing it. They were all trying to do what they felt was right. So that's where I came from. I don't fear, let's put it this way, I probably fear change just as much as I ever did. But I'm open to the process, and it has done so much for me that being static could never have done. I'd still be standing back there with a desiccated heart and not an ounce of growth. We need to change in this country. Our Congress needs to change. I'm sick and tired of hearing they don't reach across the aisle. Why did we send you there? Why? Which one of you has the perfect philosophy? You both have a piece of the truth. You both have part of the vision. Now put it together for us, because you're failing the country. You're failing the Constitution, and you're failing the Christian response to life. You're certainly failing the God of creation. Now get over it and get on with it.
Sister Joan D. Chittister, OSB, is an American Benedictine nun, theologian, author, speaker. She has served as prioress and Benedictine Federation president, president of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, and co-chair of the Global Peace Initiative of Women. Her brand new book, it is titled The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage. It is inspiring. It is timely. Sister Joan, I can't tell you how grateful I am for you giving us this much time and for sharing your insights and wisdom with us. You are always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
God bless you, my dear brother. If I've done anything today, it's because I was able to watch you and your group, what you've done to help to stretch our belief in every direction with great respect. I will always honor. Thank you for having me. God bless you.
Last weekend, a diverse group of prominent leaders, religious and otherwise, made a pilgrimage to Selma, Alabama, the scene of the infamous Bloody Sunday massacre 54 years ago on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. This year, Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline made the journey along with the civil rights hero Congressman John Lewis and other notable people. I'm happy to welcome Jack back to State of Belief Radio now for some highlights of this memorable pilgrimage. Jack, thanks for being with us again.
This is a subject near and dear to my heart and a place near and dear to my heart, so I'm glad to be here.
Last week, we heard you speaking on the Supreme Court steps, and this week, we're getting your impressions from Selma. You're a busy guy.
Yeah, I get around a little bit. One of the things that is so remarkable to me that I never would have believed because I'm not much of a mystic is that I can actually sense the footsteps of people who were in places before me when I go to important locations like that. When I stood on the steps of the Supreme Court, I was conscious of the fact that many others, including you, had stood there before me. And when I walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, not only did I feel like I was walking in John Lewis's footsteps, but my children have all made that pilgrimage as well, and I could feel them with me as well. So I was very full.
Well, tell us what the pilgrimage in Alabama is all about.
For many years, the Faith and Politics Institute has been running this trip under the sponsorship, the patronage of Congressman John Lewis. Every year, a significant delegation of members of Congress and the Senate join in this weekend of retracing some of the footsteps of the civil rights movement. And of course, the centerpiece is always the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which 54 years ago, this past weekend, resulted in a change of public position by President Lyndon Johnson and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So it's an important time to remember.
How does music and culture play into the overall history and ongoing momentum of the civil rights movement?
So, you know, it's a great question, Wilson, that I really did not consider well until this past weekend. What I know about the civil rights movement, I like to think, is mostly what I've read in history books and before that in the first draft of history in the newspapers. But what I realized this weekend was that what I really know in my bones about the civil rights movement is what I have seen and heard and felt, not so much through language, but through the experience of music and art and particularly the photographic arts. And that was the focus of our pilgrimage this past weekend, was to revisit some of the art that conveyed the message of the civil rights movement. I'll give you a small photographic image that most people, I think, will remember. There is an iconic photograph of John Lewis as a young man being clubbed over the head by an Alabama state trooper at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. If you look closely at that photograph, as I have many times, you can actually see the baton bouncing off his head as he falls to the ground. That has a profound influence that simply reading that the marchers were stopped by the troopers and attacked by them when they crossed the bridge. On the pilgrimage, we also sat in the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, which was the pulpit that Dr. King held when he was a very young man. He was in his mid-20s, and from which he announced and organized the bus boycott in Montgomery that so much shaped civil rights in the South. And while we were there, Congressman Lewis called on Betty Mae Fikes, who was really the sort of the voice of the movement, to sing a song for the people who were assembled in that church. And when I tell you who was there, it was senators, it was members of Congress, it was people who are well-known. I don't want to say celebrities, but people who are well-known. And in one of those things that can only happen at an event like this, Caroline Kennedy showed up with her family. She was just there touring Montgomery, and she joined us. So Congressman Lewis called on Betty Mae Fikes, and he said to her, "We need to sing something." And he turned to the choir from Dexter Avenue and said, and you back her up. And he turned to the praise band and said, "You back her up too." And it was like in a movie, Welton. You know, you watch these things and you say, oh, you know, Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, let's put on a show. But I have to tell you, I witnessed it with my own eyes. I think we have a clip. Maybe you can play it here.
Great. What a wonderful moment. You know, Jack, it strikes me that this commemoration must have been very different from just a few years ago. I think we've seen racism exposed in this country in ways and in places that would have been hard to imagine. So how much of this felt historic and commemorative, and how much of it was timely and urgent?
So I was on the pilgrimage on the 40th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which was 14 years ago. And it was a big deal. President Clinton was there and spoke, and a large group of people from a cross-section of America was there to march across the bridge and attend a rally in commemoration of it. And that visit felt more like a celebration. Because we had felt that we had come so far, and everybody acknowledged we had so much farther to go. But there was really a sense that the marchers had inspired something in America that had made life significantly better for lots of people. I don't think that sense was present this time around. And I think that the members who were there, and there were Republicans and Democrats both, there were people there who were from all sorts of companies that Americans are familiar with, social media and industry and energy companies, all of whom wanted to show their support for this kind of endeavor. And I think everybody who was there was wondering what role they could play in restoring a measure of respect and civility and compassion in America. And I will say, I think everybody felt less than equal to the task. And I was able to reassure some of the people that I spoke with that by the very fact of them being in the positions they're in, they are role models to people they might recognize and they might not recognize. And that the most important thing that leaders can do right now is to comport themselves in a way that causes admiration. Of course, legislators have laws to pass and businesses have businesses to run. And of course, these things should be done in a manner that enhances the American experience. But on a person-to-person basis, each of us is a teacher to more people than we can imagine, and to live your life admirably, to get into good trouble, as John Lewis likes to say, that's what really is the way for people to address the malaise in this country right now.
Jack, would you take a few minutes and talk about the work Interfaith Alliance is doing specifically around racism and racial discrimination? Not everyone understands how core to the organization's mission addressing these issues truly is.
So, Welton, I'm a Jew and you're a Christian. I know that's not news to you. And we have within our sphere of influence, people who are Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, Buddhists, and atheists. One of the things that we all have in common, however else we view the world, is that we believe that there is an inherent dignity in every human life that has to be respected and treated with the same consideration, the same equality that our founders recognized when they declared that all of us were created equal in the first document of the United States of America. And so everything we do at Interfaith Alliance flows from that notion that every person who is a citizen of this country, never mind the citizen of the world, but every person who is a citizen of this country deserves equal protection under the law, respect, equal consideration, and the ability to the quiet enjoyment of their life that ought to be the right of every American. So our engagement in issues of racial justice, in issues of religious freedom, all flow from that basic understanding of the equality of every human soul.
What specific issue are you currently focusing on with urgency that is important in our nation?
So I say this with some trepidation, but I say it nonetheless. There is a lot of conversation going on right now about how and if Congress should react to inflammatory language, both by members of its own body and by people in society in general. And we're doing just about everything we can think of to try to turn the temperature down. We learned from a social media posting just how hot these topics are. And all we did was call for a certain amount of cool heads to prevail. So we're concerned about that now. And at the same time, I'm very involved in the promotion of the Equality Act that will extend the provisions of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to people of differing gender identities and orientations. So these are the two things that at this moment, as you and I speak, are occupying most of our attention at Interfaith Alliance.
Please tell our listeners how they can get involved in the work of Interfaith Alliance.
There are really three ways that people can be involved. The first is to keep yourself informed. Visit our webpage, interfaithalliance.org, and take the actions that we recommend on that page and the various issues that we're promoting. And similarly, make sure to keep listening to State of Belief. That's number one. Number two is to be active. And being active can be as simple as picking up the phone and calling your legislator in Congress or in your state house to make sure that religious freedom issues are being protected and are being promoted in the proper way. And the third way, of course, is to contribute. To contribute your dollars, we'd be very grateful for them. And you can do that at our websites as well, both the radio show and the organization itself. And to contribute your time, we'd love to have you as a volunteer for our efforts to be a point person for us in your locality when religious freedom issues come up, and they come up all over the country. So there is nowhere that someone is listening to my voice where their hand and heart would not be important to us.
Rabbi Jagmeline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all. Thank you for regularly being willing to come on this show and be a vital part of State of Belief Radio.
Welton, there's very little that we do that is more important than your voice on the radio and Ray Kirstein's production of it. So thank you, too.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.